From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how the U.S. squandered its technological lead and what that means to our national security and economic health. We'll talk with Martin Tolchin, co-author of Selling Our Security. Also, performing in a live sitcom, we talk with actor Rocky Carroll from the TV series Rock. And rock historian Ed Ward continues his look at the Scepter record label and the woman behind it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Toronto Blue Jays have clinched their first American League pennant with a 9-2 victory over the Oakland A's. It's the first pennant ever won by a Canadian-based team. Toronto will face either Pittsburgh or Atlanta, who will play their seventh game tonight. The end of the American League Championship Series means that tomorrow's presidential debates will begin at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. If there had been a seventh game, the debates would have been moved to an earlier time. Bill Clinton is resting his voice and preparing for tomorrow night's debate in Richmond, Virginia. Today, his campaign reacted to a report in the Washington Post that administration officials had ordered embassies in Oslo and London to search his passport files. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The Clinton campaign described the search as another smear. George Stephanopoulos, the campaign's communications director, called on the administration to disclose whether officials in the White House or at the campaign had authorized the search.
Seems to be a pretty outrageous abuse of power, blatant use of the State Department for political purposes.
Administration officials say the searches were done in response to Freedom of Information Act requests from news organizations. The campaign pointed out that according to State Department regulations, an FOIA search of Clinton's draft status, student visas, and citizenship could only be expedited under unusual circumstances. According to the campaign, the State Department violated its own rules for partisan political advantage. In Williamsburg, Virginia, I'm Mara Liasson.
Texans began voting in the presidential election today as part of a 3-week early voting period that has replaced the state's absentee balloting. Election officials say that at least 1 million Texans are expected to vote during the so-called no excuses period, in which people are allowed to vote early without having to give a reason. A French physicist and an American chemist were named Nobel Prize winners today by the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. NPR's Richard Harris reports the prizes recognize a landmark discovery and a landmark invention.
The invention is the electronic eye that's at the heart of every atom smasher in the world right now, the window through which the invisible world of the atom can be glimpsed. It was invented in 1968 by physicist Georges Charpak, who works at the giant particle accelerator on the French-Swiss border. About a dozen other Nobel laureates made their discoveries with the instrument that Charpak invented, and today he joined them on the honor roll of science. The Nobel Prize for Chemistry went to Rudolf Marcus at the California Institute of Technology, not for an invention, but for a discovery. He inspired a whole new field of chemistry by figuring out one of the most important chemical reactions on Earth, one that allows plants to get energy from sunlight and allows us to get energy from the food we eat. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 6 points to close at 3,195. This is NPR. President Boris Yeltsin has released Soviet documents on the downing of a Korean Airlines jumbo jet in 1983. Yeltsin said the Soviet government concealed the truth about the disaster, in which Soviet MiG shot down KAL's Flight 007 after it strayed over Soviet airspace. All 269 people aboard the plane, including 63 Americans, were killed. The Soviet government contended that the flight was part of a joint American and South Korean spying mission. The documents included transcripts of radio exchanges between the plane and ground control and other planes, as well as transcripts of the contents of the aircraft's cockpit recorder. German and Jewish leaders have called for stronger police intervention to counter right-wing violence against foreigners in Germany. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
German Chancellor Helmut Kohl met today for the first time with Ignaz Bubis, the newly elected head of Germany's Jewish community. Both leaders urged police officials and the justice system to confront right-wing violence with all available means. Since his election, Bubis has criticized the German government for failing to take stronger action against the growing number of anti-foreigner and anti-Semitic attacks. Bubis also paid an inaugural visit to German President Richard von Weizsäcker. Both called for the active support of the entire German population to stop the attacks. Meanwhile, Franz Steinkühler, the head of Germany's largest union, proposed a forum of all democratic forces to stop the trend towards right-wing violence. For National Public Radio, this is Dieter Berger in Frankfurt.
Retail sales were up slightly last month, partly because of the cost of rebuilding from hurricane damage in South Florida and Louisiana. The Commerce Department said that sales rose 0.3% in September. Commerce Secretary Barbara Franklin said the September figures are evidence of an ongoing recovery. Other analysts were less impressed, saying that the information shows an economy that's barely growing. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've been warned that America is losing its technological dominance. Can the United States remain a world leader if it loses its technological edge, if it depends increasingly on other nations for technologies vital to its military security and economic competitiveness? My guest Martin Tolchin says no. Tolchin is co-author of the new book Selling Our Security. He's also a reporter for the New York Times. He says America is losing out in several ways. Foreign investors are taking over American companies, and foreign companies often have the competitive edge in the market because they have government support. Tolchin says the U.S. hasn't learned how to deal with economic adversaries who are political allies. He told me some of the industries we've lost out on.
We have lost the lead in semiconductors. We invented VCRs. They're no longer made here. Very few TVs are made here. We have lost the lead in robotics. We are losing the lead in genetics. We had 100% of the world's lithography market 10 years ago. Today we have 20%. In 1970, the Japanese had none of the world market in DRAMs, dynamic random access memories. Today they have 80%. We used to be the world leader in semiconductor production, and it's steadily declined to 35% now. And so we are either behind the curve or out of play.
You know, how much of this has to do with the fact that a lot of American companies have been bought out by foreign interests?
A great deal, and we think that's a major factor. And we don't blame the American companies as much as we blame the American policymakers. We also think that some of the blame should be cast on American corporate executives who have not had the vision, the foresight to commercialize their products. And we also think that a major problem is that the American people are not investing in America. There's a basic failure to invest here, to save money and do something with it. We are a total consumer economy, and we have amassed enormous debt.
Now, the fact that we're losing our technological edge worries you. Part of the reason why is that you think it can affect our national security.
Exactly.
Well, how would the industries that you've just mentioned going to affect our national security?
Well, we found in the Gulf War that we had to call on our ambassadors all over the world to supply, to get foreign nations to supply essential parts. And we don't believe that it's possible to be technologically independent. We do believe, however, that it is imperative to be interdependent, that we have to depend on others, but we have to have others depending on us as well. And as the tire industry has shrunk and machine tool industry has shrunk and industry after industry has gone down the tubes, we feel that we are losing our position to negotiate with other companies and other countries. And this was really brought home very vividly in the Gulf War.
Well, you say that a diagram of the General Dynamics fighter aircraft, with the F-17, Looks like a miniature UN because the parts come from just about all over the world.
Exactly.
So what does that mean? What's your interpretation of that?
We think that it's fine for parts to come from all over the world, but we have to be a player. We have to have something. We have to manufacture something that other people want and need in order to get the things from them that we want and need.
Is this a security risk if you have an aircraft fighter with parts that are made in different parts of the world?
I don't see it as a security risk as much as an overdependence. We had the Department of Commerce had a report in 1990 that found that of 12 key technologies, the United States was losing ground in all but three, and we have that in our book. There have been reports by Department of Defense, which was required by Congress to compile a list of 20 critical technologies and where we stood vis-a-vis other countries. And we were well ahead in most of those technologies, but there were quite a few in which other countries had the lead. And many of those technologies were developed here, such as the microchip was developed here and to a large extent commercialized abroad, such as VCR. In effect, we are in the position that Great Britain was in after the First World War, when penicillin was discovered there but commercialized here. Now we continue to be the great intellectual resource of the world. We pour billions of dollars into research and development, but we just are very sluggish in commercializing what we find, and we let other people do it.
Well, what do you think the government can do in that dilemma? You're saying that we're good at creating new technology, we're not good at continuing to manufacture and sell it. So what kind of government role do you see in that?
Well, we think that the government should play a very important role in nurturing these technologies in many ways, in perhaps relaxing antitrust restrictions against emerging technologies, allowing R&D combinations between various companies, direct subsidies. You know, the four European countries subsidize the Airbus. The Washington policymakers were very derisive about that. Now the Airbus has taken flight, literally and figuratively, and has become just a major competitor in the aircraft industry, while McDonnell Douglas, one of our companies, is being sold, or 40% of it is being sold to Taiwan.
Well, you say that former President Reagan and President Bush have found it hard to reconcile their commitments to free trade and to national security. What kind of conflict does that pose for them?
Well, I think it's a conflict for both conservatives and for liberals. I think that conservatives believe in a strong military, and they believe in a strong economy, and they believe in economic competitiveness, but they don't like government intervention in general. And they don't like government intervention in the corporate world, especially. For liberals, the problem is the reverse. Liberals don't resist government intervention, but they are not that concerned about a strong military. This is traditionally. I think today the lines are being blurred. But one part of the problem here is that both conservatives and liberals in the Congress and in the body politic have, for very different reasons, totally committed themselves to a free trade, laissez-faire attitude with regard to our technologies. And this is an attitude that is shared by none of our major trading partners.
So American companies are competing with foreign companies that have the support of their government.
Exactly. It is true that much of the problem that American industry faces has been created by corporate management. There's no question about that. But I think it is also true that much of the problem has been created by a very unlevel playing field in which our companies are more or less left to go it alone against foreign companies that have extraordinarily deep pockets and great government support.
You talk about an unlevel playing field. One example you use is Japan. Now, Japan has cartels. The equivalent of cartels. We oppose cartels. We oppose monopolies in this country, and this poses a real dilemma. I mean, you wouldn't want to see us return to the days of monopolies.
Of monopolies or cartels. I totally agree. But I think that we have to realize that when we are dealing with a company that owns a bank and that owns a manufacturing base and that owns research institutions and that owns an extraordinary amount of things, of vertically integrated company in Japan, they're called Keiretsu's. We have to realize what we are dealing with, and we have to somehow cope with that. And I am very much opposed to our development of monopolies or cartels. But I think that the answer for us is, first of all, to have some kind of coordinated government policy. One of the things that we recommend is something resembling the Japanese Ministry of Industry and Technology, MITI, to coordinate. Right now we have our technology policy decided by the Pentagon and the U.S. Trade Representative, the Department of Commerce, the Exim Bank, about a dozen different agencies, some of which are often at loggerheads. But when, for example, Japan sat down to negotiate the FSX, they brought in their equivalent of commerce and DOD and everybody else, and they had a very unified plan. And I think that we should recognize our limitation in trying to do in our way, in our splintered way, what other governments do in partnership with their companies.
So what do you think America should do to adjust its antitrust policies?
I think we should relax them, certainly as far as research and development is concerned. I think we ought to allow companies to combine in terms of research and development. And in effect, actually, that is beginning to happen because the antitrust laws really are not being applied. Actually, the antitrust laws have been extremely lax during the last 12 years. But they are not being applied that rigorously to research and development. But we ought to really say flat out that we ought to encourage research and development partnerships between various companies.
How would that work?
Well, they would no longer be subject to antitrust laws. You would have, IBM working with, say, Intel to develop a new chip. Now, it is true we have Semitech, which is a consortium of companies that use chips in their industry, and more companies do this. This is a government, this is a consortium between the government and these companies. Incredibly, the automobile industry is not yet part of this consortium, and I think, again, you have to look at the short-sightedness of American companies. I think one really striking example of the short-sightedness of American companies is their failure really to avail themselves of university-based research, research that is paid for by American taxpayers. Many research institutions, such as the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Caltech, have programs that they refer to as industrial liaison programs, which enable all companies to pay a fee, and last year I think it was about $100,000 a company, to get an advanced peek at the research that is being done at these universities, and also to get university scholars and researchers to help them with any problems that they have encountered. In the marketplace, and anything that they need to overcome the marketplace. And the chairman of NEC, Nippon Electric Corporation, credits his corporation's membership in the MIT Industrial Liaison Program with giving it giving his company a great advantage in the computer industry. Unfortunately, American companies do not really avail themselves of this, whereas foreign companies do. And I think it also raises a question about whether universities should be able, in effect, to sell federally funded research to foreign companies. This is research that is really paid for by American taxpayers. MIT receives $640 million a year from the federal government for research, which is a heck of a lot of money. And that research is paid for by American taxpayers. And it strikes me as kind of bizarre that people who pay taxes to support this kind of research may be working for companies that are disadvantaged by programs, by the industrial liaison programs of these universities.
If you're just joining us, my guest is New York Times reporter Martin Tulchin, who's the co-author of the new book, Selling Our Security, The Erosion of America's Assets. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martin Tulchin, author of the new book, Selling Our Security. So do you think that we should not only have the government support certain industries in the United States, and you also suggest change the antitrust laws a little bit, do you think we should also be setting up certain barriers to foreign companies to help level the playing field?
I don't like barriers. There's something about barriers that I think strikes me the wrong way. We have been the most free country in the world in terms of our people coming in from everywhere, our money coming in from everywhere. We've gotten ideas from everywhere. We've gotten products from everywhere. And I think it served us well. Rather than barriers, I prefer nurturing.
Nurturing?
Nurturing our companies.
Oh, I see.
Nurturing our companies to make them more competitive rather than keeping other companies from selling their products here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If you'd like to see the American government support certain American industries, who's going to decide which industries are of such significance to the economy or national security that they deserve the support?
Well, this is the criticism that is lodged against, quote, industrial policy, quote, or, quote, technology policy, end quote. My own feeling is that all of our allies do it, and they're usually right. Not always, but they're usually right. We have a Pentagon report issued every 2 years on what they consider the critical industries to be, and our standing vis-a-vis other countries in developing those critical industries and technologies. We have had a lot of people studying this problem, and I would say that even though we may not target 100% of the critical industries, and even though we may guess wrong occasionally, I think that there are some very, very smart people around who are really involved in this subject.
I don't need to point out how much in debt America is. Where would the money come from to administer such a program and the money to help the developing industries?
Well, ideally, the money to administer this kind of a program would really come from the additional jobs that would be created by these technologies. You know, you take something as simple as a device that's now going to be operational and on Japanese cars, I think in 3 years or 4 years, and this device will enable the motorist to sense traffic patterns in front of him and tell him if there's a traffic tie-up down the road, let's say 5 miles or 10 miles down the road, and give him other routes that he might take to his destination. Now, once that technology becomes available, if we don't have it, we are going to be at a tremendous disadvantage. American automobile makers are going to be at a tremendous disadvantage. These technologies create jobs, they save jobs, and I think that's where this financing will come from.
The economist Robert Reich, who's actually one of the advisors to Bill Clinton, has made the argument that ownership doesn't matter now because we're in a global economy, and so many companies are multinationals anyways. You know, it's hard to tell. He asked the question, who is us? You know, it's hard to tell now on the global economy.
Right.
So what's your response to that?
I believe in capitalism, and if you believe in capitalism, ownership does matter. I think ownership is very important in determining the development of various technologies, of various industries, and it's also very important not just to the people who work for those industries, but to all the so-called service economy, the lawyers, the advertising people, the Harvard MBAs. They are not given the same opportunity with foreign companies as they are by American companies.
You know, one of the arguments against this kind of industrial policy that you're talking about is that it comes from a certain xenophobia, that people are afraid of the Japanese, people are afraid of the Germans. Do you think that that's a fair criticism of the kind of policy that you're advocating?
I think that there is some xenophobia. But I think it's because of the policies we have followed, not because of the policies that we are advocating. I think there is some xenophobia because our policymakers in Washington have been impervious, really, to the surge of foreign investment. And the problem really is not with all foreign investment. I have personally no problem with foreign investment in real estate, unless we're talking about a cultural landmark. I have no problem, let's say, with the purchase of a machine tool company or a tire company or a semiconductor company. But I do have a problem when there are so many purchases that our own production begins to go below 30%, below 20%, below 10%, and sometimes down to zero.
One last question. Do you think that people, that policymakers play on xenophobic fears in order to get their point across? Do you know what I'm saying?
I think people are getting
whipped up about the Japanese and the Germans and everything.
I think they do. And I think also part of it has been an insensitivity by some of the overseas investors on what they purchased, purchasing things like Rockefeller Center that have meaning above and beyond.
Have certain symbolic meaning.
A clump of stone, yeah.
Martin Tolchin is a reporter for The New York Times and author of the new book Selling Our Security, The Erosion of America's Assets. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Rocky Carroll of the TV series Rock. Carroll plays the brother who sponges off of Rock. The series is live this season. We'll find out what that means for the actors. And rock and roll historian Ed Ward continues his retrospective of Scepter Records, the label that gave us the Shirelles, the Isley Brothers, and Dionne Warwick. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee has called for an independent counsel to investigate why the FBI, CIA, and the Justice Department withheld information in a case involving illegal bank loans to Iraq. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
Senator Boren questioned the Justice Department's prosecution of the Atlanta bank manager who provided $5 billion to Iraq. Why, asked Boren, did the Justice Department insist this man worked alone instead of looking into leads his bosses in Rome were well aware of the illegal loans? Boren said CIA documents withheld from prosecutors should have given rise to intense questioning of Italian officials. While Boren is focusing on whether top U.S. officials deliberately shaped the case, he said there are other questions. Why would the U.S. government want to cover up this case? Did U.S. officials condone the BNL loans? The Attorney General refused an earlier request for a special prosecutor, but in light of new information, Boren has asked him to reconsider. If he does not, Boren says he will go ahead with hearings, but not, he said, until after the election. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Once again, President Bush and Democratic challenger Bill Clinton are getting ready for another debate, while independent Ross Perot stayed out of public view today. With only 3 weeks to go before the election, Mr. Bush spent about 90 minutes in a make-believe debate with Budget Director Richard Darman standing in for Clinton. Clinton is in Williamsburg, Virginia, taking care of a throat that is hoarse from allergies and overuse. One thing observers will be watching tomorrow night is the size of the viewing audience. If there is a large drop-off, it might indicate that many voters have already made up their minds. Medical reports released today on Bill Clinton indicate that the Democratic presidential candidate is in good health. Ben Fry of member station KUAR in Little Rock reports.
According to four doctors who have treated Clinton over the years, the Arkansas governor has had no major medical problems. He is on prescription medicine to control allergies and has been told to try to talk less to protect his voice. But in letters released today, the doctors say recent cardiac and blood tests have been normal. Clinton did have what is described as a mild elevation in his cholesterol level last year, but that had returned to normal as of this week. His weight is also described as normal for his age. A check of Clinton's vocal cords found no problems except for some swelling. He also has had a mild hearing loss. For National Public Radio, I'm Ben Fry in Little Rock.
The government says that retail sales were up a bit last month. The Commerce Department says that sales moved up by 0.3% in September. Economists had been expecting a slightly larger increase. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 6 points to close at 3,195.48 in active trading. This is NPR News. Aftershocks continue around Cairo in the wake of a major earthquake there earlier this week. More apartment buildings have fallen in these latest tremors, sending residents fleeing into the streets. The Egyptian government says the death toll from Monday's quake is now up to more than 450 people. Thousands of others were injured. Before these latest collapses, more than 500 buildings across the nation had either been destroyed or badly damaged by the quakes. Thousands of people have started sleeping outside at night, fearing more tremors. A UN team has now arrived in Iraq for high-level talks on humanitarian conditions there. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
The head of UNICEF met with Iraq's foreign minister and is scheduled to talk with other top Iraqi officials. The UNICEF team is there to assess the needs of Iraqi children and to conclude arrangements for delivering humanitarian relief this winter to Kurds in northern Iraq. Since the end of June, the UN has reduced its relief operations because Baghdad refuses to extend an agreement permitting it to do so. Iraq has also blamed a UN embargo for what it claims is a soaring infant mortality rate. And UN officials were greeted today by a children's protest, apparently arranged by the government. Food and medicine are exempt under sanctions, and Baghdad has rejected UN terms for selling some oil to pay for humanitarian supplies. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney says he finds it deeply disturbing that this year's presidential campaign is not focusing more on foreign policy and defense. Speaking in New York City, Cheney said even the candidates themselves have failed to center on foreign policy. While Cheney said he knew how important the issue of the economy is to the country, he said the end of the former Soviet Union is far from settled, and it would be very risky to assume it will be orderly. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The TV series Rock is live this season, and it's the first primetime comedy series to be broadcast live since the 1950s. The three leading male actors are used to working together without the benefit of retakes. They starred in the Broadway production of August Wilson's play, The Piano Lesson. One of those actors, Rocky Carroll, is my guest. He plays Joey, Rock's younger brother. Rock is a garbage collector. Joey is a musician who seldom has a gig, lives rent-free at Rock's house, and often takes advantage of Rock's generosity. Joey is also a ladies' man. In this recent episode, Joey brings home a woman and, to impress her, tells her that he supports his brother Rock. When Rock finds out, he is not amused and drags Joey to the living room for a talk.
What's up?
Well, for starters, I want to thank you for letting me live in your house.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm sorry the furniture's a little tacky. But...
Hey, well, Joey, this is my house. You know, it's bad enough you're sponging off me. The last thing I want to hear you going around telling people I'm sponging off you.
All right.
Now go in there and tell that woman the truth.
That's a good one.
I ain't asking her.
Right. If I do that, she'll walk out on me.
Well, you should have thought about that before you lied. Now get in there and straighten it out.
All right, fine. But you owe me another woman.
I recently spoke with Rocky Carroll and asked whose idea it was to do the show live.
Charles Dutton had a lot of input on it because he came out to L.A. thinking that he was going to do something different, a different type of television show. And the first season was good, but I think Rock was a little disenchanted. He wanted to do something that really raised the stakes as far as television. So I think he had a lot of input into saying, let's give it a chance. You got a cast of four stage actors who work live theater. Let's up the stakes a little bit. Let's remove the net from out of the high wire. Let's do it live. So I'm pretty sure Rock had a lot of input as far as us doing it this way.
You call him Rock, Charles Dutton?
Yeah. Yeah, because that is his real nickname. Charles Dutton's real nickname is Rock.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So how is it different doing the show live than it was taping?
Well, I think the biggest difference is in the energy. I mean, just people say that they can see it coming off the screen. It's just there's an intensity level that's so much higher because when you're doing a show on tape, you may be doing retake after retake, and you're going well into the night, and you're doing the 11th take of someone crossing from one part of the room to the other, and the energy just starts to wane. So when you know that you've only got one shot, and you've only got one chance to do it and to do it right, the intensity is so much greater. And I think that's the major difference as far as the difference in doing it live and tape. And just as far as us having to deal with the studio audience, which is about 250 people who actually sit and watch the show on the set, we now have to play to that audience. We can't run over a line if the audience reacts, if they laugh or whatever. We have to not only listen to each other, but we have to listen to the audience to make sure that the lines are delivered clearly and, you know, are not covered up by the laughter or whatever reactions may be.
Since you have to end exactly on time every week, do you worry about what happens if everybody reads their lines too slowly one week and the story is still going on while the broadcast is ending?
You know, that's funny because last week was the first time we actually went a little long, that we got to the last scene of the show and the credits were rolling before we finished. And the director, before we did the show, had said to us, he said, you know, the adrenaline gets so high, you guys have a tendency to rush. And usually the show runs faster. And last Sunday, I think we were all conscious of that. So everybody tried to slow it down. And what happened was it went a little too slow. It's not something that we can really be concerned with as actors. I mean, you know, it's while you're doing it, it's trial and error. It's going to take a little getting used to. I mean, we've been on the air doing this show live, just a little over a month now, I think maybe a month and a half. So we're still learning those things. We're still getting a sense of that timing, you know, and how to pace ourselves. So it is something to worry about, but I think it's more on the part of the director and the people behind the camera to keep us, you know, keep us abreast of how we're doing time-wise.
Well, when you were going a little long, were you getting signals from the floor director of like, read those lines more quickly, please?
No, we didn't hear any of that until after the show was done, was that we'd gone a little longer. We just made it because it's, like I said, the intensity and the focus it takes to do this show and to do it live, you really can't, even when there are commercial breaks and people are, you know, you're changing and getting ready for the next scene, you really can't step out of that world and have people coming up to you and saying, you know, like you're on the sidelines and going, okay, now let's try to do this a little more. You got to get all that out of the way before the show starts, because mm-hmm. there's just too much at stake doing it live to have people step into that space and try to give you notes and directions while the show's going on. It's just, I think you know what I'm saying. It's just, it's too, it takes away your focus.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rocky Carroll. He plays Joey on the series Rock. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Rocky Carroll, who stars in the Fox TV series Rock. He plays the part of Joey. Interesting group of actors on Rock, and interesting stories behind how they started acting. Now, Charles Dutton started acting while he was in prison. Carl Gordon, who plays the father, started to take acting lessons at the age of 33. He was working in a department store at the time. What's your story? How did you start to act?
I was very fortunate. There was an alternative school program in my hometown of Cincinnati. So by the sixth grade, I had auditioned for this high school of the performing arts. Well, junior high school of the performing arts. And in the sixth grade, I was in a performing arts setting. I was learning about dance, theater, music. I was playing in a band. So my school schedule was, in the mornings I was doing my academics, and in the afternoon I was rehearsing or I was performing or learning something about the theater. So from the sixth grade on up through my graduation and then on to a college conservatory education, I was studying my profession.
What was your neighborhood like when you were growing up? What was the neighborhood?
It was Cincinnati, Ohio. It was a neighborhood called Mount Auburn. Mm-hmm. Blue collar, very family oriented, the mm-hmm. working class neighborhood. You know, just we were kids. We, you know, we went to school, we came home, we ran and we played, we got into trouble. We, you know, there was nothing exceptional, and I wasn't looked at as an exceptional person either because I was going to a performing arts school. I think it was a very nurturing community because, like I said, it was a working class community, and it was just, I think, had I gone to some school and been isolated and sort of lost track with my friends and family, that I wouldn't be the same actor as I am now.
Did your parents work when you were growing up?
Oh yeah, my dad worked for McDonnell Douglas. He was an aircraft mechanic. He worked on jet engines, and my mother worked as a makeup consultant at a department store.
Huh. So did she help you with your stage makeup?
No, not really, because we didn't really get into the stage makeup aspect until a little later in life once I started performing professionally, and then I was out of town. But just like I said, they were always supportive of me, and nobody else was really much of a performer until, you know, my father told me, you know, years later that he had always wanted to do it as well. And also other family members of mine had said, you know, I had always dreamt of doing that too, but you're the one in the family that's actually doing it. So I think I'm living out a dream of a lot of my other family members as well.
Now, I was on vacation the week in August for the episode when Rock and your father throw you out of the house.
Uh-huh.
Because they figure that's the only way you're really going to start becoming financially independent is if they get you out of there.
Right.
And I was on vacation for the follow-up episode. I've seen a tape of the episode where they throw you out. Mm-hmm. I wasn't around for the next. What happened after that?
What happened after that was, you know, Joey landed on his feet again. I always say, to put it in gambling terms, he rolled a seven. You know, the dice fell his way. A friend of his who's an accomplished musician, has a, you know, really nice condominium apartment, had to leave town for 3 months, so he gave Joey the keys and said, keep an eye on my apartment, on my Mercedes, and I'll be back in a few months. So Rock and the rest of the family come over to see Joey, you know, in his apartment, expecting to find him in some hole in the wall. And here he is sitting in this, you know, this swank condo, getting his, you know, driving a Mercedes. So the chips fell his way this time.
Is he moving back in?
You know, I don't know. I think what I would like to see is before everything gets wrapped up and a nice little bow be tied around it, I think Joey's going to have to go through a little more adversity before he, you know, before he goes back home or before things, before he finds some kind of, you know, even keel as far as where he lives.
So
he may even be in a homeless shelter again, you know.
So you don't know what the writers have in store for you?
Not at all. Not at all.
Do you like that not knowing?
No, I love it. I accept the challenge. I accept the challenge of doing the show live. I accept the challenge of the writers coming to us and saying, this is the script, this is what we're going to do.
It's kind of like life itself. You don't know what happens next.
Yeah. I mean, that's the bottom line. You just do it. When it's all said and done, you know, people may think, man, they were absolutely nuts for doing a live TV show. Or who knows, people may say, man, that was the most incredible thing that they did on the air. That was such a bold and courageous thing. But we can't look at it as, right now, I can't look at it and think, how is this going to affect, you know, what are people going to say about me and about this show years from now? I can't look at it. This is what I'm doing right now. This is the job I've chosen to do.
Rocky Carroll plays Joey Sunday nights on the Fox TV series Rock. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We'll have some political analysis as usual tonight. Also, the story of some traveling we did this past summer up to Alaska and across the Bering Strait to the Russian Far East. That border was closed up tight in 1948 and stayed closed for four dark, icy decades. It's open now. There's lots of traffic back and forth, lots of business opportunities developing, plus among some of the native peoples of Alaska and Russia, the chance for families to be reunited after all that time. We'll get to meet some of the people who involved in opening the border, private citizens who were helpful in making that happen, in lifting what they called the ice curtain.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Scepter Records was one of the last great independent rock and roll labels. A new box set offers a retrospective of the label's music, and that's the occasion for a look back by our rock historian, Ed Ward. Yesterday, Ed described the rise of Scepter Records in the late 50s and its discovery of the Shirelles and Dionne Warwick. Scepter concentrated on Warwick even to the point of passing on Aretha Franklin when she was offered to them in 1966. Today, Ed tells us how the label wound up bringing black music into the middle of the road.
If you see me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet, walk on by.
By the end of 1963, Scepter Records was 5 years old, and the nutty dream of Florence Greenberg, the middle-aged Jewish housewife from New Jersey who'd started it on a whim, had come true. With her ace producer, Luther Dixon, she'd established the Shirelles as one of the nation's top acts, launched the careers of Chuck Jackson, Maxine Brown, Tommy Hunt, The Kingsmen, and Dionne Warwick, and was nurturing the songwriting and production careers of the dynamic team of Burt Bacharach and Hal David. Mrs. Greenberg had turned into a very savvy businesswoman, and the industry took her very seriously indeed. What could go wrong? Nothing, really, but things could change. Luther Dixon had proven himself, and now Capitol Records was offering him an awful lot of money to take his Lou Dix Productions operation to their company. The slick Bacharach and David Productions weren't his thing. Mrs. Greenberg gave him her blessing, and Dixon left. But the rougher R&B records were important to Scepter's catalog. Who would produce them? The answer was her son, Stanley.
Since I found you, baby.
Ooh, since I found you.
Since I found you.
Actually, Stan Greenberg had help on some of his productions, like that Maxine Brown number, from Ed Townsend, a sometime singer who would later produce Marvin Gaye's mature masterpieces. But Stan did okay by himself, too.
When my friends told me you had someone new, I didn't believe a single word was true. I showed them all I had of faith in you.
And, like his mother, he had good ears for emerging songwriting talent.
We, the Girls' Society, we find him guilty.
No, I'm innocent.
We find him guilty.
No, I'm innocent. I've been accused of cheating on my best girl, but I swear I wouldn't do her wrong. For nothing in this world.
We find him guilty.
No, I'm innocent.
We find him guilty.
No, I'm innocent. A witness says she saw me.
That Chuck Jackson-Maxine Brown duet might be the first big break Nick Ashford and Valerie Simpson got. Since the 1963 blockbuster Louie Louie, Scepter was always interested in regional hits recommended by their field promotion staff. So when Steve Tyrell, their Texas guy, told them about a Houston show band, the Triumphs, Mrs. Greenberg lent them an ear. She liked what she heard.
Did you hear that lonesome whippoorwill? He sounds too blue to fly. Is wine and low, and I'm so lonesome I could cry.
The lead singer, Billy Joe Thomas, BJ Thomas, was tall and handsome, and it wasn't too hard to talk him away from the band and into recording with Steve Tyrell in Memphis.
What you do to me.
The electric sitar and Hooked on a Feeling notwithstanding, Mrs. Greenberg stayed well away from the psychedelic craze, steering Scepter ever closer to the middle of the road. There would be one more soul hit and one more rock hit, though, and they were good ones. Get On Up by the Esquires is a classic Chicago Sound soul record, even though the group was from Milwaukee. As for the rock record, in the grand tradition of Louie Louie, it wound up banned. The Boys, the group that wrote and recorded Timothy, swore the record wasn't about cannibalism, that Timothy was a mule, but that cut no ice with most radio stations. As the 70s wore on, most independent record companies aligned with major labels or disappeared. Thanks to Dionne Warwick's string of hits, Mrs. Greenberg was able to keep Scepter going until 1976, working with Sam Goff, the man who'd married her daughter, the one who'd brought the Shirelles to her attention. But finally, the label had to fold. Mrs. Greenberg retired, a wealthy woman, thanks to her crazy idea. Her story would make a great movie, an idea which has not escaped Disney Studios, who are planning to make one, starring Bette Midler as Florence Greenberg. Sounds like a hit to me.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. The box set The Scepter Record Story is on Capricorn Records. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Voblaitis, and Joyce Lieberman. Kezia Perlman is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Just hold on tight.